in the book of Esther, in chapter number 9, God's word reads, "Now in the 12th month, that is the month Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's commandment and his decree drew near to be put in execution, in the day that the enemies of the Jews hoped to have power over them, though it was turned to the contrary, that the Jews had rule over them that hated them. The Jews gathered themselves together in their cities throughout all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus to lay hand on such as sought their hurt, and no man could withstand them, for the fear of them fell upon all the people. And all the rulers of the provinces and the lieutenants and the deputies and the officers of the king helped the Jews, because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame went out throughout all the provinces, for this man, Mordecai, waxed greater and greater. Thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, and slaughter and destruction, and did what they would unto those that hated them. And in Shushan the palace, the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men. And Pershandatha, and Dalphon, and Aspatha, and Poratha, and Adaliah, and Aradatha, and Parmashtha, and Arasai, and Aradai, and Vajasatha, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, slew they, but on the spoil laid they not their hand. On that day, the number of those that were slain in Shushan the palace was brought before the king. And the king said unto Esther the queen, the Jews have slain and destroyed 500 men in Shushan the palace, and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, what is thy petition, and it shall be granted thee? Or what is thy request further, and it shall be done? Then said Esther, if it please the king, let it be granted to the Jews which are in Shushan to do tomorrow also according unto this day's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged upon the gallows. And the king commanded it so to be done. And the decree was given at Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. For the Jews that were in Shushan gathered themselves together on the 14th day also of the month Adar, and slew 300 men at Shushan, but on the prey they laid not their hand. But the other Jews that were in the king's provinces gathered themselves together and stood for their lives and had rest from their enemies and slew of their foes 75,000. But they laid not their hands on the prey. On the 13th day of the month Adar and on the 14th day of the same rested they and made it a day of feasting and gladness." We're going to stop in our reading right there this evening. The great reversal. The great reversal. I cannot speak in the behalf of everyone here, but I know that in my own life, there have been times that I was so sure something bad was going to happen. And in fact, I could honestly say I've worried myself sick sometimes about what may happen. And that's not to say that sometimes we're not right and trouble doesn't come. But more often than not, I have found that I worry myself over nothing. That God has a way of working things out in a far greater way than I ever imagined. And in the same vein, we find the people of God during the time of the pagan Persian king Ahasuerus, who thought, no doubt, that something awful was about to happen. And they had good reason to think that, for there had been a law passed stating that something awful was about to happen. Yet God, in His great mercy, intervened in a mighty way and brought about a great reversal of what they thought would transpire. I'm particularly interested in a little phrase that is found in verse number 1. It's a parenthetical phrase. And if I may lift it up out of the page, it says, though it was turned to the contrary. And that's just exactly what God has the ability to do, to turn things to the contrary. A great reversal that the Jews had ruled over them that hated me. I really think, and for whatever it's worth, that it would be well that we saw this 9th chapter right on the hinge of the close of chapter number 8. I want to remind you, as I do from time to time, that our chapter and verse divisions are given to us by the translators as a means or a source of help to us. But they were not there originally. In the original writings, they did not exist. And I think chapter 9 is best viewed within the confines of the last couple sentences of chapter number 8. Because I think it is clearly relates to what takes place in chapter number 9. So look with me, if you would, there at the 17th verse of chapter number 8, just the last couple of lines. It says, "And many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them." If you'll remember, and I won't rehash all of the story, but if you'll remember, things had completely turned around for the Israelites, and in particular for Mordecai and for Queen Esther. If you'll remember, Haman had sought the life of Mordecai, but also all of the Jews, and the king turned all that around and ended up killing Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. He gives to Esther, his queen, all the land and all the vast property that Haman owned. And then the queen falls down before the king and says, "Oh, that's great, but there's still a problem. The problem is that there's a law on the books stating that on a certain day in the 12th month, but all the Jews can be killed." And so she intercedes in the behalf of her people, and the king grants her request. And if you'll remember in this last chapter, she had said, I want you to reverse the law, but if you've been here with us at all, you know the laws of the Medes and Persians can't be reversed. They can't be changed. It's irrevocable. Once it's on the books, it's on the books. So last week we talked about how Mordecai very wisely wrote another law, a second law, that on that very same day, and my illustration was, though it doesn't fit really the time, but my illustration was that if we were to put it on today's calendar, if you would, Haman's law was originally written and set out in January. Mordecai's law, to contradict that, was written some 2 months later, say in March, and it was all based on this one day in December. And you understand those are not exact dates. I'm just using that for instance here. I actually sat down and read one commentary, and it said that this happened in June, and another commentary said it happened in March, and I don't know which one of them may be right, and it may both be wrong for that matter. But anyway, it was determined by Haman's edict or command that on one day in the 12th month all the Jews could be killed. And then after the king turns everything around, and really it's God who does all this, but he works through this Gentile pagan king, and Mordecai is brought into authority. Mordecai says, on the same day in that 12th month, now the Jews can defend themselves. And as we approach the close of chapter number 8, it becomes obvious. I think it becomes obvious to many people that there is indeed a God in heaven who rules and reigns. And I think that's exactly what happens when you read these words at the close of chapter 8 when it says, "And many of the people of the land became Jews." I think very, very simply they converted to Judaism, if you will. They recognized that there is no God like this God. There must be a true and living God of the Jews who has done these things to see everything turned around, from Haman being the prime minister to being impaled on the gallows, and his mortal enemy Mordecai is now the man running the show. And for life, death to be set aside and to be turned around in such a great way, I am convinced that many of these people of the Persian Empire recognize that there is no God like the Jews' God, like our God. And so they became Jews. And if you'll notice, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them at the close of chapter number 8, they recognized that their God is the God. And as we get into chapter 9, it fast forwards. You know, when you're sitting down and reading this, you don't realize it. Very, very easily you can skip right through it. But chapter number 9 fast forwards about 9 months. In chapter 8, it is the third month when Mordecai sent out his command stating that the Jews could defend themselves. When we read chapter 9, we step into the narrative on that very day. That very day that had been written about now, both by Haman and by Mordecai. In chapter 9, it says, "In the 12th month, that is the month Adar, and on the 13th day of the same month, when the king's commandment and his decree drew near to be put in execution," read these words, "in the day that the enemies of the Jews hoped to have power over them." So this is the apex. In fact, if you are a Jew reading this story, you know that this is the apex or the climax of the story. And here it is. That final day. 11 months earlier, Haman had passed a law that said the Jews could all be killed and all their property seized on this day. And for 2 months, they lived with that looming over them until Mordecai comes into authority. And then once Haman is disposed and Mordecai is set into the seat of authority, he passes a law that on that very same day the Jews could defend themselves. And this is what I call a showdown. This is the day. If you wanted the royal right to kill your Jewish neighbor and seize all of his property, you had the royal right to do that. But if you were a Jew, you also had the royal right to defend yourself, kill your enemy, and seize his property if you wanted to. And so there's these two commands clashing one with another. And it's more than just two commands clashing one with another. It is two empires clashing one with another. It is God wrestling with Satan, if you will. It is the good battling the evil. I've tried to tell you to look beyond the page to see the spiritual battle that is taking place in the book of Esther. There's more than just what you can see with the natural eye. There's a spiritual war. And it is Satan doing everything within his wicked power to try to destroy the Jews and, if possible, destroy the lineage of the coming Messiah. And so on this fatal day, all who wanted to kill the Jews and seize their property could. But also, all the Jews could defend themselves from their enemies and seize the property. First order by Haman, second order by Mordecai. And as we read this, it's easy to read it without feeling any emotion. It's easy to read this because we've got all of the book of Esther. We know how it's going to turn out. We realize that the Jews are going to be well protected, right? We've read the book. We know how it plays out. But if you are an Israelite, and it is the 13th day of the 12th month, you're going to rise up early that morning with a certain measure of concern in your heart as to what is going to transpire that day. You don't know whether or not an entire army of people in your community are going to rise up against you and fall on your family and kill them all. So there's a certain amount of angst that existed in the hearts of the Jewish people. We know, you know, it's easy for us to sit back and say, fellas, what y'all worried about? You know, God's got you. Don't sweat it. God's going to take care of it. But that's easy for us to do when we're reading about them. It's not necessarily so easy for us to do when it is our own lives. And we wake up in the morning with a little angst in our heart because we're waiting to hear from that doctor's report. Or that son who didn't come home last night and you're concerned about what they're into. You know, there's any number of things that we could put into this scenario. It's easy to sit here and say, you Israelites don't have a thing to worry about. God's got your back. But we need to remind our own selves of these very truths often, do we not? They didn't have the full revelation that we do. They didn't know that things were going to go as well as they were going to go. I will say to you that not only did the Jews survive this day, the Jews thrived on this day. There is a clear measure of poetic justice in this book, and in particular in the last couple of chapters that we have studied. And we need to be reminded as we study this and in our own lives that even though our enemies may be many, and they plot, plan, and scheme our harm, ultimately God will deliver His people. God will deliver His people. See this Jew haters and Jews clashing on this day. Whether it is actually in the month of March or the month of June, I cannot say for sure, or some other time, but we know this, that at this time, it is that day that has been written about. It is that day when the swords will clash and spears will be thrown, blood will be shed. As there are many people who seek Jewish genocide. And verse 1 clearly tells us, right from the very beginning of this chapter, that things go well for God's people. That little parenthetical statement at the close of verse 1. The writer says, it's the day that the enemies of the Jews hope to have power over them, in verse 1. This is the day that they hope they could annihilate the Jews, murder the Jews, take all of their lands and property. But the writer says, I want you to know early on, it turned to the contrary. It was a great reversal that the Jews had rule over them that hated them. And that's good news. Now, he's going to take the next few verses and expound on that. But perhaps we should put ourselves in that little verse and remind that even though we do have an enemy, that he seeks our harm, God in His sovereign rule will turn it to the contrary so that God's people will have the rule or dominion over them that hate them. See what happens in verse number 2? The Jews gather themselves together in their cities throughout all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus to lay hand on such. Notice these words, as sought their hurt. See, this wasn't some open-ended edict that just said, you can go out here and maul and maim anybody you want to. That's not what this is. This is not a license for vengeance. This is not a license to go out and settle scores. What this is a command written by Mordecai under the authority of the king, sent out to say that any of the Jews could defend themselves against those that tried to harm them. They were allowed to lay hand on such as sought their hurt. So if you woke up on that fatal day and you have made up your mind, you've been planning now for months, that you're going to attack your Jewish neighbor had the right to defend themselves. And friends, while God's Word clearly teaches us that we should, let me say it like it says in Romans, as much as is possible, as much as lies within us, we should live peaceably with all men. Still, we have the sovereign right to defend ourselves. And I do believe that we even have the obligation, a biblical duty, to protect our families. And there are some people who, the reason I say that, some people who try to attribute wrong or immoral behavior to the Jews because of this, saying, look at these Jews shedding all this blood. And the only blood that was shed by the Jews was shed against those that sought to harm them, hurt them. If you didn't seek to harm your Jewish neighbor, then they wouldn't harm you. But they had the right to defend themselves. In verse 2, I underline these words because I think it leaps off the page. It says, and no man could withstand them. That's the great reversal, isn't it? No man could withstand them. Even though there, now listen to this, and you need to get, there is a vast number of people who delighted for this day to come because they wanted to exterminate the Jews. Even though there's a vast number of people who sought to inflict great harm on the Jews, still God blessed them so much that the text says no man could withstand them. That's how great. You want to talk about a one-sided battle? I believe that's exactly what this was. I'm not going to stand and say with 100% absolute definitive, no questions, that there was no Jew harmed, hurt, or killed, but I can tell you this much, it was at the very least a very one-sided battle. These Jews went to battle and no man could withstand them. And I think part of that is to close verse number 2 because then people were shaking in their boots. The fear of them fell upon all the people. They gathered together to protect themselves, and protect themselves they did. They had the divine right to defend themselves and they defended themselves. None of the enemies could triumph over them, though they tried, because they were so afraid of them. And I think you and I need to be reminded here that it's not those people that the enemies needed to be afraid of. It was the God of those people that they needed to be afraid of, right? And an interesting turn here is verse number 3. And all the rulers of the provinces, and the lieutenants, and the deputies, and officers of the king, and again, I underscored these little words, help the Jews. Isn't that pretty fascinating? All the people who had any royal authority, who did they help? They helped the Jews. Now, it could be argued that they did this to curry favor with Mordecai, and maybe some of them did. Maybe they realized, I don't want to end up like Haman ended up. I don't want to get on the wrong side of God's people. And so they helped the Jews, and the rulers of the provinces, the lieutenants, the deputies, the officers, they helped the Jews. And the close of verse 3 says, because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. For Mordecai, verse 4, was great in the king's house. And his fame went out throughout all the province. This is the same Mordecai that had covered himself in sackcloth and ashes and went out into the center of the city and fell down with fasting and weeping and mourning and praying, has now been elevated to the highest position within the Persian Empire underneath the king himself. And he has been given, and I think there is a supernatural, divine wisdom given to him, like was given to Joseph and like was given to Daniel, so that they could rule well over these Gentile nations. For Mordecai, verse 4, was great in the king's house, and his fame went out throughout all the provinces. Listen to this. For this man Mordecai, who had taken in his little orphan niece who didn't have a home, this man Mordecai, who was a godly man and who was instrumental in encouraging Esther to go stand before the king and intercede in the behalf of the people, this man Mordecai waxed greater and greater. I think Mordecai is a good example of godly behavior, a good example of how you and I should try to conduct ourselves in an ungodly world. He showed patience and he showed love. He was a man of prayer, commitment. These things are certainly important for us. Verse 5, I think, is really a super important verse that is found here. Thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword and slaughter and destruction, and did what they would. Another way of saying that is they had their way with the enemies. I think most likely easily destroyed them. Mordecai is in charge. God's people have been blessed. I don't think it's a stretch by any imagination that word had got around that God was blessing these Jewish people. And you didn't want to stand against them. But I promise you, there were still plenty that hated them. That sort of shows you the depravity of man right here, that God has blessed and done these miraculous things in raising up Mordecai. Esther the Jew sitting on the throne as queen. Haman completely disposed. Hearts of the people in a great way are feel the fear of the Jews, but there's still some who insist on rebelling. A lot of them who insist on rebelling. Even though those that did, in verse 5, the Jews smote them. I want to fall back on what we read about Samson, where Samson smote them hip and thigh. Samson just had his way with the Philistines. I sort of think that's how the Jews had that day. Notice the close of verse 5. And did what they would unto those that hated them. Again, unto those who sought them harm, to those that hated him. And verse 6 tells us that in Shushan the palace, the Jews slew 500 men. That's a pretty good slaughter right there to lose 500 men. 500 servants. Perhaps some of them some role of authority. We do not know, but some 500. So that tells me that Haman's hatred towards the Jews was not limited to Haman, but that it had spread throughout the palace. Haman wasn't the only one that wanted to see the Jews eradicated. There was a vast number of them right there in Shushan, the capital, and in particular in the palace itself that hated the Jews. And so just in Shushan, the palace, 500 men died. So that tells you something about the size and the power that the Persian Empire had, that 500 servants go to war against the Jews on this day and die. It must have been a pretty good sized palace that man had. He must have had a lot of people in it. Servants or workers there at that palace. In verses 7, 8, and 9 is the names of the 10 sons of Haman. They're listed there. Not only were 500 men killed, but Haman's 10 sons were also killed. And you say, man, that's cruel. Well, they lifted up their hands against the Jews, and because of that, the Jews defended themselves and killed them. I just remind you of what I've tried to labor to you, is that this was not just a free reign to go out and kill who you want to kill. If you intended hurt or harm against the Jews, they could well defend themselves, and they did. And it's obvious that they sought retribution for what happened to their daddy. These 10 sons of Haman thought, we're going to bring down vengeance on Mordecai and these Jews because of what has happened to our father. And all 10 sons of Haman are killed. We might say, as is often quoted, the sins of the father were visited upon the sons. In verse 11, we see that the king receives a casualty report, if you would. I need to stop and back up just a little bit because vitally important. I'm sorry. The close of verse 10. Verse 10 says, the 10 sons of Haman, and their names were listed, they were killed. The enemy of the Jews, they were slain. But on the spoil laid they not their hand. Now that's the first of three times that that's mentioned in the text that we read. Now, the Jews had, if you're interested, you can flip back real quick to chapter 8 and verse 11. Chapter 8, verse 11, at the close of it, it says that the Jews had the right to take the spoil of them for a prey. The Jews had the right that anybody that they killed, anybody who had tried to harm them or attack them, if the Jews killed them, they had the right to lay claim to their gold, silver, property. But the Jews, not a single one of them, took anything that belonged to their slain enemies, to the fallen enemies. They didn't take any of it. And although it's tough for you to remember all this, I have the privilege of trying to stay in this salt. And a lot of this animosity that existed between Mordecai and Haman goes all the way back to King Saul and to the king of the Agagites. The Amalekites, Agag, Saul kept a lot of things he wasn't supposed to keep. On this day, the Jews, even though they were allowed to keep the spoil of their enemies, they didn't keep any of it. It's reaching way back to the beginning of this study, but there was animosity that existed between the Israelites and the Amalekites because the Amalekites had attacked the Israelites when they were first coming out of Egypt. In fact, remember, they attacked the old people and the children. And because of that, God said, destroy them all. But instead of destroying them all, King Saul kept some of the best animals and gold, silver, kept all of that, even though God had said, get rid of it. And that ended up costing King Saul the throne. And he ended up chopping King Agag, they chopped him up to pieces. The king of the Amalekites chopped him up in pieces. That's one of the reasons why Haman hated the Jews like he did, because he was a descendant of King Agag. He was one of the Amalekites. But here I think, and I think you, if you were a Jew, you would see this much more clearly. I think you would see they refused to take anything from their enemies, any of it, even though they had the royal right to it. They said, we will not. You remember when Abraham delivered Lot? The king of Sodom said, come, you can have anything you want. And Abraham said, I won't even take a shoelace from you. I don't want anything from you. God's given me this victory. And God will supply all our needs. And I think that's what Israel does here. They don't lay claim to any of that. But anyway, sorry, verse 11 says that there is a casualty report given. On that day, the number of those that were slain in Shushan the palace was brought before the king. So the king finds out. He doesn't know about everything. You understand this is a vast empire that stretched for hundreds of miles. They couldn't get online on social media and say, we killed 300 here and 500 here. They didn't have any of that kind of stuff. But he does receive a report finding out how many men had died in Shushan the palace. And in verse number 12, the king says, and I'm going to put this in my vernacular, the king says, honey, the Jews have slain 500 men right here in the palace, and the 10 sons of Haman. Who knows how many other people have been killed in this empire? But he says unto her, now what do you want? Tell me what you want. And that's verse 12. The king says to Esther, the Jews have slain and destroyed 500 men and the sons of Haman. What? I mean, just think. I think that's him saying, just imagine what's been done in the rest of my provinces. But yet he asked her, what now is your petition? What do you want now? What is your request now in verse number 12? Just ask me and I'll give it to you. And you know what? She has an answer for it. She has an answer for him. You might think she's going to say, you know what? We've got everything we want. We've got to defend ourselves. Let's just call it a day. No. Queen Esther, and I believe with some godly wisdom, says, well, I do have one more thing to ask of you. And we find her reply in verse number 13. Esther says, if it please the king, notice this, let it be granted to the Jews which are in Shushan, in the capital city, that tomorrow they may do the same thing that we've done today. Do you get it? It was on the 13th day of the month that this had occurred. And so we would gather that it's somewhere around evening now of that day. The king receives a report that 500 men have been killed. And so he says to the queen, what more do you want from me? Look what's been done. Your people have readily defeated all of their enemies. What more do you want? And she says, let my people go out again tomorrow and defend themselves again. Right here in Shushan, the capital. Now, they understood this was not throughout the entire empire. They couldn't have sent word throughout the vast empire. Like, you know, so many hundreds of miles, they couldn't have got word out. But she says, right here in the capital city, let the Jews tomorrow stand and defend themselves again. And she says, you like it or not, but there it is. Take the 10 sons of Haman, who are already dead, and let their lifeless bodies be impaled upon the gallows. That's pretty tough talk from a lady, isn't it? I'm serious. I mean, that's pretty tough language. I want you to take the 10 sons of Haman that have already been killed, and I want you to take their lifeless bodies and impale them on the top of the gallows so that everybody around here knows you don't mess with the Jews. You don't lay your hand on God's people. And I think that's exactly why she does this. The reason why in crucifixion, almost probably, crucifixion, as it was found during the time of the Roman Empire, found its roots right here in Persia, where they would impale people on these poles. And both of them were meant to make a statement. This idea that Christ was crucified back where nobody could see is just silly. It was done in a very public place to make a statement. Here's what happens if you cross the Roman Empire. And it would be as if they put capital punishment on primetime TV, it would probably deter crime, right? If we saw capital punishment on primetime TV, it might deter some crime. But that's exactly what crucifixion was intended during the Roman time and what this hanging on the gallows was intended during the Persian time. But this was the queen, I think, in a preventative way for the future to say, here's what happens when you mess with God's people. And I know that is strong language, but I really believe that she wisely says, you take those 10 wicked sons of wicked Haman and you put their bodies out there on public display. And in verse 14, the king agrees. The king commanded it to be so. And the decree was given at Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. Verse 15, for the Jews that were in Shushan gathered themselves together on the 14th day. So this was originally the 13th day. Now it's the next day, on the 14th day. And they slay 300 more men. So that should again reiterate to us. Now some of these liberal commentaries say, oh, that's just make-believe, it's just fiction, it's just made up. I don't believe it. I'm going to take the Bible for what it says. Now, they killed 500 there on one day, and there was still 300 of them the next day that tried to kill the Jews, and the Jews defended themselves against them. So if you have 800 people die who were servants or had some role, whether they were people of dignitaries or wealth or whatever that they were, if you have 800 people who die there at the palace, it must be a pretty good sized palace with a lot of servants, a lot of people there. But again, do you see the close of verse 15? But on the prey they laid not their hand. And just for the sake of time, look at the close of verse 16. But they laid not their hands on the prey. When we read repetition in Jewish writing, what does that tell us? It tells us it's important. If we read it one time, we're to learn it. If we read it twice, it means sit up and pay attention. Here, three times in these few verses, we are told that the Jews refused to take anything from the enemies that they had killed. Verse 16 sort of turns the narrative away from Shushan the palace and looks broader now. Not just looking at the capital city or the palace itself, but verse 16 takes us, obviously it's written by someone who had intricate knowledge of what took place, but verse 16 looks at the empire as a total. Verse 16, the other Jews that were in the king's provinces, not in the capital city, but in the king's provinces, gathered themselves together and stood for their lives and had rest from their enemies and slew of their foes 75,000. Now just stop. If many of the people converted to Judaism, if many of them saw what happened and said, I don't want to get on the wrong side of these Jews, but still 75,000 were killed because they wanted to attack the Jews. Imagine what the slaughter would have been like if the Jews had not been allowed to defend themselves. Just think about that. It would have been a merciless genocide of the Jewish people. But God reversed that, did He not? In a great reversal, instead of the Jews dying, 75,000 spread out over the vast Persian Empire were killed. But they laid not their hands on the prey. And verse 17 tells us on the 13th day of the month Adar, that tells us that's when all that took place, outside of the capital city, outside of the palace. They only had one day. Inside the capital and inside the palace there was 2 days, and that'll matter as we finish the chapter next week. But the 14th day, verse 17, of the same month, the people rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Inside the palace, there was 2 days of fighting. Outside of the palace or outside of the capital city, there was one day of fighting. The 75,000 were killed by the people outside on the 13th day, and on the 14th day, they had rest. And you may say, man, that's a lot of information. And how does any of that apply to us? Well, I bring you back to where I began. You and I need to be reminded that we're not victims. We're victors. In fact, we are more than conquerors through Jesus Christ. I know we have enemies. And I think perhaps more than we even want to give thought to, we have enemies who would seek to harm us or hurt us. Satan and sin and our old flesh wars against us. But God will bring about a great reversal. The enemy will not win by the shed blood of the Lord Jesus Christ. We'll win. We are the conquerors. We are not some conquered foe. We are conquering through what Christ has done. If you will stop and make this application with me, God has brought a great reversal in our lives too. There was a law written against us, an irrevocable, irreversible law, not written by men, but written by God. And that law said, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. That law was written, and we are guilty. But praise God, there was another law written as well. That first law meant death, but that second law meant life. Haman's law brought death to God's people. Mordecai's law brought life. I love Romans 5. I'm going to read it to you as we close. Romans 5, verse 6 says, "For when we were yet without strength, in due time Christ died for the ungodly. For scarcely for a righteous man will one die, yet peradventure for a good man some would even dare to die." But listen to this, "But God commendeth His love toward us, in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us." Yeah, there was a law that said death, destruction, and misery. But where sin abounded, grace did much more abound. And Christ brought life. There is another law also written by God, and it is a law of love. Though we were condemned and guilty, and we were condemned to die, yet God wrote another law, and He sent His Son to fulfill it, that we could have life and a future. Now that's good news. That's a great reversal, isn't it? From death, doom, and despair to life, joy, and eternity with God. It may seem like the enemy's going to win, but the enemy won't win. It may seem like things are out of hand, but God will cause His people to prosper. And like Mordecai, you know what I think we should do? I think like Mordecai, we should spread this news with all haste, that there is life and that more abundant for those who put their faith in the Lord Jesus Christ.